I know there's a lot going on in the country right now, a lot going on in the world for that matter. And so what I thought I might do very briefly is just talk a little bit about kind of what's happening in Washington, D.C., and some of the things that we've been involved with. I don't know, in terms of this forum, I think it's question and answer, so I'll try and allow plenty of time for that. But I just wanted to say that to start, first off, it being from western South Dakota, having grown up in Murdo, I have a great appreciation for what makes this part of the state tick. And I know many of you in the room are involved in some form with the travel industry and in all the industries that rely and depend upon it and support it. And that's kind of how I grew up. I grew up in Murdo. My dad was a school teacher and a coach. He was the athletic director at the school, and he drove the bus. So there wasn't anywhere I could go to get away from my dad when I was growing up. And my mom was the school librarian, so they kind of had the whole school base covered. But all of us kids had summer jobs, and we all worked in the tourism industry in one way or form or another. My older brothers pumped gas at filling station in town. My sister and I both worked at a restaurant in town. My younger brother worked at the Pioneer Auto Show, which is the big attraction that draws people off the interstate when they get to Murdo. And this was kind of our center of gravity when we did business and we had a doctor and things like that. We'd get to Pier occasionally, which is a little bit closer, but we spent an awful lot of time out here in Rapid City. So for me, this is kind of like being home. I love western South Dakota. I love its beauty. I love the people out here and always relish the chance to make it back here. One of the things that strikes me about what's happening in national politics these days is it's very popular to run kind of against Washington, D.C. and run against Congress, which I get. I mean, I think that's always been true. It's always been anybody who runs for office, you know, wants to create a predicate for change. And that essentially is what I think our presidential candidates on both sides this year attempted to do, is to try and talk about what we need to do differently, what we need to change. And in doing that, of course, they kind of attack the status quo. And what I wanted to, I guess, point out briefly today is that in as much as there's a lot of frustration with Washington at things not getting done, and I'll be the first to admit that there are a lot of things, big things that we keep putting off that need to be addressed, reforming the tax code, reforming our entitlement programs, issues like that, that there are on a basic functional level, things have sort of restored to working order. We've actually been able to get a lot accomplished in the last couple of years. And I'll just to illustrate the point, when we took the majority in 2015 in January, things had kind of shut down in the Senate. And there was a high level of frustration that, people were being shut out of the process. People weren't having an opportunity to have their voices heard in the process in the Senate. And so we decided to open that process up again. And one way to do that, of course, is to allow the committees to function, to operate in regular order, to report bills out to the floor when they come to the floor as best we can to try and open up the amendment process, allow for debate, allow for votes. That's how people have their voices heard. And when you do that, there's a sense of ownership and investment in that process, and it's a lot easier to get people to buy in and to get things passed and signed into law. And but just to illustrate the point, in 2014, which is the last year that I was in my party was in the minority in the Senate, we only had, if you can believe this, the United States Senate, the world's greatest deliberative body, 15 votes on amendments to legislation in the United States Senate. So when we took the majority, we immediately decided one of the things we wanted to do was to open up the process. And so in the last couple of years, although it's never perfect, I mean, the Senate is the Senate, and it's designed to be very inefficient, I think, by our founders, we found a way to create an opportunity for people to get their voices heard in the form of votes on amendment legislation as it moves its way across the floor. In fact, the U.S. News and World Report there, as you can see on the bottom, said less than a month into this session of Congress, the number of amendments voted on in the Senate has topped 2014's total amount an entire year. So that was the design to try and get things moving again. And this was the Washington Times note. In terms of bills passed over the past several years, we consistently sort of ramped that up over time as well. And let's go to the next one, Wes. And we really tried to focus on two areas. One is economic security, addressing the economy. The economy's been very sluggish, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. and then national security. These are the two issues that we tried to focus on, and what are the policies that we can put in place that will create the conditions that are favorable to economic growth, to get the growth rate back up to a faster rate. And secondly, you know, when it comes to national security, what can we do to better enhance our security? And I always tell people that if you don't get national security right, the rest is conversation. If you can't protect the country, then none of the other things that we talk about really matter very much. And so there are a number of things that fit under that general category of issues that we tried to work with. And I'll just give you a case in point. Next slide. One of the bills we just recently passed through the Senate was one that I was involved with. It originated in the committee that I chair, the Commerce Committee, and it's the FAA reauthorization bill. Now, in the area of the Commerce Committee, and it's Commerce, Science, and Transportation is the name of the committee. I took over the chairmanship of that committee in January of 2015. And it's got a very broad jurisdiction. I call it planes, trains, and automobiles. We have pretty much everything transportation related. We have communications, so telephones, internet, all that stuff follows under our committee's jurisdiction. We have the space program. We have oceans, anything that deals with oceans, something I've had to get a little bit more familiar with coming from South Dakota. We have some sort of novel issues. We have all the professional sports organizations, so the NBA, Major League Baseball, the NFL, and we have the Olympics. The United States Olympics Committee is under our committee's jurisdiction, so we deal with those types of issues. But it does create an interesting discussion in terms of when people get in your ear. People want to hold hearings on a whole range of topics, and we have to decide, is that something we want to have a hearing about, have an oversight hearing about? And when I first took over the committee in January of 2015, of course, the Super Bowl was, late January, early February. And, remember the story about Tom Brady deflating footballs? Well, I had people in my ear, even on my committee, saying, we ought to have hearings on this. And I was like, I really don't think that we need to dabble in whether, how much air the NFL decides to put in a football. I think that's something they ought to be able to decide. But you do get suggestions like that. It's a committee that has a very wide jurisdiction. But one of the issues that we deal with, and we've actually had a very successful run of legislating on that committee, and I work very carefully with my ranking Democrat, he's a guy from Florida, Senator Bill Nelson, and try and work with both sides when we write legislation to get bills that we think can attract broad bipartisan support, both on the committee and then ultimately when they get to the floor of the Senate. And so in those areas I mentioned, planes, trains, and automobiles, and since we took over the majority, we got a multi-year highway bill passed, first one in since 1998. And that, of course, deals with infrastructure issues. Something's very important to South Dakota. We're a farm-to-market economy. We need trucks. We need trains. We need containers to get a lot of our commodities to their ultimate destination, to the marketplace. And so we legislated in that area. We also, and we got that bill on the president's desk. Eventually, he signed it into law. We moved a bill that reformed our freight rail system in this country, first time in 20 years. It had been 1996 since that was done. And we moved that through our committee across the Senate floor into conference with the House and got that on the president's desk, and he signed it into law. And then just 2 weeks ago, we took the federal aviation, so we're dealing with the aviation issues, and we passed that bill out of our committee, moved it across the Senate floor, and eventually the House didn't get theirs through the full House, but they moved through a bill through committee, so we kind of went to conference with them, negotiated a compromise, and put it on the president's desk, and he signed it into law. So, we've had, over the course of the last couple of years, a lot of successes in the areas that we deal with. And one of the reasons for that is because, as I said, that can happen when people feel like they've got buy-in. And on our committee, the FAA reauthorization, this one right here, which I mentioned, is a good example. When we brought it in front of the committee, we opened it up the amendment process. We ended up accepting 34 Democrat amendments, 23 Republican amendments. When we got it to the floor, we adopted another 20 amendments, split evenly between Republicans and Democrats, and we got 95 votes in the United States Senate for that bill when it left the Senate. Now, when it came back after we'd negotiated an agreement with the House and it got voted on before it was sent to the president, it got 89 votes. And so, things can happen. Things can bust loose, but people have to feel like they've got some ownership. And in that amount of time, since January 2015, we've had 73 hearings in front of the Commerce Committee. We've had 15 markups. We have reported out 77 bills out of our committee, and we've seen 42 become law. So it's been a, you know, when people say nothing's happening in Washington, things are happening in Washington. It may not be the things that people want to see happening in Washington, but we are actually seeing some progress. And this bill, the Washington Post said the newly passed air travel legislation is an amazing win for consumers, because not only did we deal with issues of aviation security and safety, and when I mentioned national security is one of our priorities, it included a number of provisions that are designed to make those areas of our airports that are most susceptible to a terrorist attack more secure. We've looked at a lot of the recent attacks in places like Brussels. The Metrojet airliner that left Egypt, you know, was a bomb was put on there by somebody. It was an employee inside the airport. So we've looked at all these recent incidents and tried to figure out what are the gaps, what are the vulnerabilities that we have in our aviation security system. And we tried in this legislation, there were a number of aviation security measures put in there. In fact, it was the most comprehensive reform when it comes to aviation security in about a decade. And then we did some things on the consumer side that I think consumers are probably going to end up liking. One of the things that you'll find when you travel in an airport these days is in many cases they'll charge you for luggage. And so you pay a fee to, you know, put your bags on the plane. Well, what happens when they lose your luggage? Do they refund it? No. And so in the bill, if you don't get your luggage back in a certain amount of time, the airline has to refund the luggage fee. So, I mean, it seems like those are fairly common sense type things, but that's why I think the Washington Post said what it did. What else we got up here, Wes? In terms of aviation security and national security issues, one of the things that that we worked really hard on, and this has been like a 10-year process, and the Commerce Committee was instrumental in this too, because we have jurisdiction over the FAA, and the FAA had a lot to do with getting the training range approved out here, but the training space out here in Ellsworth now, which we could quadrupled in size and created all kinds of new capabilities, is going to be a real asset for the military. Already has been. I mean, they've been conducting large force exercises out there. They're going to continue to do that. When I talk to our commanders, they consistently tell me that training range, training space is so critical and so important. They have to be able to simulate the kind of conditions that they're their aircraft and their pilots are going to see in the theaters that we operate in today. And so that not only is going to be really important for our national security interests and making sure that our crews are trained and equipped for the challenges they're going to face, but also very important for this base out here. Because that was one of the areas in the last BRAC round that was a shortcoming for us, was not having enough or having access to training ranges. So expanding the training range and giving it more capabilities is really important. So there's a couple things I wanted to point out that actually have been getting done in Washington, D.C. Now, having said that, there are a lot of challenges. I'll be the first to acknowledge that. And when I talked about focusing on two issues, economic security and national security, when it comes to the issue of the economy, we're not in a real good place. And, if you look at the number of people who are not in the workforce today, it's an all-time record. And it's actually, you hear the labor participation rate, the number of people that are working that could be working, the percentage is at an all-time low. Now, that isn't true necessarily here in South Dakota. We've got a really low unemployment rate in South Dakota. But there are an awful lot of people who completely dropped out of the labor force. The cost now for health care for employers and for employees has really gone up. The average deductible on a bronze plan, exchange plan right now, is $5,700. The average American household, that one on the far right in the lower corner there, is making 6.5% less than they did back in 2007. So wages have gone stagnant, flat, in some cases gone backwards, at a time when everything else has gone up in people's daily lives. And if you want to explain why Donald Trump and why Bernie Sanders had a following this year, that's it. I mean, the middle class is feeling increasingly squeezed, and there's this sense that people are being left behind in the economy. And that's probably one of the biggest reasons. I mean, food costs more, college education costs more, healthcare costs more, wages have gone backwards. And so the economy is growing at a very anemic rate. About 1.55% average during the President Obama's presidency. And if you go back historically, to coming out of a recession in particular, the average growth rate has been 3.7% coming out of a recession during an economic recovery. The historical growth rate is 3.2 to 3.5% since the end of World War II. And so we're nowhere near that. Why does that matter? Because the growth rate in the economy, when the economy is growing and expanding at a faster rate, it's creating better paying jobs. The wage level, household income starts to rise with it. When you're growing at 1% to 2% a year as opposed to 3% to 4% a year, it makes a profound difference in the kinds of jobs that are out there, the wage levels that come with those, and it affects so many things across the board, one of which is the deficit and the debt. Now, I'm a conservative. I'm a Republican. I'm always looking for ways that we can make government more efficient. One of the things that as we look at government, try and rein it in and find ways to cut wasteful spending, but that's one side of the equation. The other side of the equation has to do with getting a faster growing economy. Because when the economists say that for every 1 percentage point increase in
policies that make it easier and less difficult to create jobs. And I think everything comes out of Washington, D.C. these days, whether it's regulations, whether it's taxes, everything else, it just seems like every policy, everything that Washington does makes it more expensive and more difficult to create jobs. And it's like putting a big wet blanket on top of the economy.
And that's why putting those types of policies in place that will generate that higher growth is so important. And so I hope that this election, that the discussion in the fall campaign is about what are we going to do to turn around the economy in a way that will enable us to get on a path to where we're growing at a more historic and more normal and more traditional rate. Because higher growth in the economy solves a whole lot of other problems. And I think part of the political angst and the economic angst and anxiety that people feel in the country today has a lot to do with the growth of the economy and the sense that people are being left, feeling they're left behind. The other issue I'll mention very quickly, again, as I said before, that we want to focus on is national security. And you can't pick up a paper or turn on the television and not find a place today around the world, and we've not been immune to it here in the United States, where you're not seeing acts of violence being committed against civilian vulnerable populations. And that is something that we have to address. And, in the area of aviation security, which, as I mentioned, is a target for terrorists, we're doing everything we can to put stronger measures in place. But when it comes to the issue of national security, the United States has an important role to play. The world looks to us for leadership. And, you've got now in the Middle East is on fire. Iran is on the cusp of acquiring a nuclear capability. Russia's becoming more aggressive. China's being more provocative in the Pacific. North Korea has a nuclear capability and a crackpot in charge of that country who I think probably wouldn't, would find his way to use it. The point very simply is that in a dangerous world, the United States has got to step up and be the leader. And I'm not saying that means sending troops every place around the world. I don't believe that. But I do believe that there is a leadership role, and countries around the world look to the United States for that leadership. And I do think being able to project strength is really critical. When President Obama took office, we were spending about 4.6% of our GDP on national security, on defense. And we're on a path right now to where it'll be about 3%. We're in a very different place. And if you talk to members of our military, and I do on a fairly regular basis, they'll say we're doing the best we can, we're trying to do more with less, but we are going to sacrifice our ability to defend this country and our allies around the world if we don't step our commitment when it comes to national security. Those are the things that I think have got to be the focal point of the discussion as we get into the elections this fall. And I know everybody in this room is paying probably close attention to what's happening. My friend Bill Walsh just got back from Philadelphia, and you know, his party's got a nominee, and he's got a smile. And of course, now that the fall campaigns are getting underway, and like I said, I hope they're about issues. I hope these are serious times, require serious leadership and serious solutions. And I really hope. I know it's going to be a lot of shooting back and forth, and I expect this campaign is going to be a fairly nasty one at the presidential level. But I hope that the focus is on what are we going to do to get this economy back on track, and what are we going to do to protect this country. With that, I'll shut up, yield the floor, as we say, and be happy to comments, questions, accusations.
Come up, state your name, and ask your question. We don't call up questions. We will, if after everybody's had a chance to ask a question, that you can come back and ask another question. And I just want to tell you, John, whenever anybody's fibbing, it cuts out.
Okay.
Let me check the first one, Bill. Okay, so and folks, we have until 1 o'clock, so we have plenty of time for questions here, Senator. I don't pretend that in this battle for the hearts and minds of public in this election, that there's one side who's always right and one side who's always wrong. I believe that everybody who's in governance has some responsibility for the actions that are taken at where you are in Washington, D.C. But with that being said, are we deeply divided in Washington, D.C. between the parties and therefore the nation? Are we so divided that we are unproductive and can't move forward? Or do we have some opportunity to work together with whomever the elected president is come November? What's your take on that?
Well, I think every election presents a new opportunity and new atmosphere. And I think people have, there's a sort of a fresh approach to things, and I hope that's the case after this election. It requires a level of cooperation that too often is lacking in Washington today. Now, when I said earlier that it's very hard to get anything done in the Senate, it is, and it was designed that way. I always tell people that our founders designed an inefficient form of government, so inefficient that no dictator can master it. But you know, we need to make it work better than it does. And I use my committee as an example of how we have, I think, effectively found common ground and been able to legislate in areas that are important to this country, that are important to our economy, important to our security. And we have to have more of that. But I do think that, you know, there are very, very different ideas. The country, I think, in terms of the prescription for how to fix some of these problems is very in a very different place. And, you know, I have colleagues in the Senate who believe profoundly that, you know, more government or expanded government is a way to fix some of these things. I have colleagues in the Senate, myself more in this camp, who believe that, you know, we want to give people more freedom. We want to lessen the burden of the cost of doing business and regulation and that sort of thing, and kind of unleash our economy and the free market economy that's worked so successfully for us in the past. There are fundamental differences in how we approach the issues, and you can't get around that. But there, you know, there ought to be a much better effort made at finding the common ground. And I do believe that can happen. And I hope after this election, however it comes out, that we take on big issues and do bold things. We need to reform the tax code. The tax code is ridiculously complicated. It's embedded costs in our economy that make it tough for entrepreneurs and businesses to make a profit and to create good-paying jobs. We need to reform our entitlement programs to make them sustainable for future generations. Those are two huge things that we've been putting off. But they're going to require a level of bipartisan cooperation that hasn't existed for some time. And I hope, as I said, that changes, because the issues are too big and the consequence is too great for us not to be able to find a way to work together and to bridge that divide. You know, I had to pass a bill. Two weeks ago, we passed a bill in the Senate. It was the Thune-Schumer bill. Chuck Schumer from New York. There aren't too many Thune-Schumer bills. But We passed it out of the Senate, sent it to the House, and so there's a level of cooperation and bipartisanship that goes on all the time. You just don't hear much about it because it doesn't sell newspapers, and it's not good for cable talk shows. You know, what sells? Controversy and conflict. And so when good things are happening, a lot of times you don't hear about it.
Father Chris.
Hi, Senator.
Father, how are you?
Good. My name is Father Chris Roussel. I'm with Emmanuel Episcopal Church here in Rapid City. I hope that you can come to our prayer service on August 30th. We're praying for peace in the country, and we'll be praying especially for you and all of the delegation. So thank you for your service. My question has to do with leadership. I was always raised to be a leader who leads by example and never asks anyone to do something that I myself wouldn't do. One of the frustrations I have with Congress are all the bills that get passed that exempt Congress from those bills. Can you maybe provide a little bit of a civics lesson to me and explain why they do that? And I personally think it would go a long way with the American public if a bill was passed that precluded those kinds of things from happening. So thank you.
Okay, you bet. Thanks, Father. Yeah, I'm not sure in my experience, and there aren't that many things that Congress does that I'm aware of where Congress exempts itself. And perhaps one exception to that, in recent history at least, was Obamacare. And that was kind of up to each individual office. So offices had the option to opt in or opt out. My office opted in. We figured if this is what everybody else around the country was going to be governed by, then so should we. So our office chose to be under that. And I know there have been times historically, to your point, where bills have passed, where Congress would exempt itself, and even, you know, things that it was imposing on the economy that it was forcing other employers and businesses to do, but they wouldn't include themselves under that. I think that's changed a lot. I mean, I don't see the I think that the belief or the perception that somehow Congress is creating separate rules for itself is something that I think is hopefully something that's a bygone era. But it's something that we need to pay attention to, because there's nothing that irritates American people more than having the political class have one standard of rules and having everybody else subject to another.
Jim White with Sound Pro here in Rapid City.
And I ran into Jim in the men's room a minute ago, so I missed him.
I washed my hands. Since you're the chair of the communications committee also, one of the big issues that I have in my business and something I'm very concerned about is broadband capability in states like South Dakota. I'm sure that Wyoming, Montana, Nebraska, other states, North Dakota, have the same issues. Have you guys had any kind of conversations about how to increase broadband capability, especially in the rural areas? Because that's something that we're going to need to go forward in a state like ours to continue to thrive in business, and it's something that I'm really concerned about.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question, and I think, you know, I was out here in the Black Hills a couple of weeks ago with my wife and family, and it was awfully hard to get signal a lot of places in the Black Hills. And interestingly enough, I had a conversation a week later with somebody who's involved with emergency services and firefighting and that sort of thing, and that's a real problem. I mean, there are huge holes out here, which if you found yourself in a situation where you needed some sort of emergency assistance, you're not going to have it. So, yes, we have to. That's part of, I think, creating a policy framework that provides the incentives for people who are in that business to extend broadband coverage to areas that are underserved and undercovered today is really critical. And the Universal Service Fund, which is something that our committee, you know, we have jurisdiction over the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, and ensuring that the Universal Service Fund is adaptable and workable to create the necessary incentives to extend those types of services to places in the country, and specifically here in South Dakota that don't have them, is really important. And that's true for wired broadband. That's also true for wireless. I mean, we've got to have both. And we moved a bill through our committee, sent it to the Senate floor, And it's being held up right now by Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, over an appointment to the FCC. So it's part of Washington politics. But what that bill essentially would do is what I call filling the spectrum pipeline. All these devices that we all have at our tables, if you hold up your iPhone or whatever, they all operate on spectrum. And if we're going to increase the level of connectivity that we have, and they say that over the course of the next 5 years, you're going to see the number of wireless devices increase from 10 billion in the world today to 50 billion, we're going to have more spectrum. So we're going to have to find ways to create new frequencies to maximize the amount that's available out there today, much of it which is held by the government. In fact, one of the biggest challenges we face in trying to free up more spectrum is the Defense Department, because they sit on a lot of this, and the government sits on a lot of this. So the bill basically creates ways in which we can better facilitate sharing, reallocation, and then creating new frequencies of spectrum to facilitate the level of connectivity that we're going to need. And just to give you an example of what this means in real life, real world circumstances, if you take that, the wireless devices that we have today, and you multiply those throughout the economy. And one thing that our committee's examined, believe it or not, is autonomous cars, driverless vehicles. So they're not that far away, believe it or not. But the driverless vehicles and the smart vehicles that we all have out there today, we're now racing with the Europeans and the Asians to get to the next generation. It's called 5G. We have essentially what is fourth generation technology today in terms of our wireless devices. So we want to get to 5G first. The difference in a driverless car in stopping or braking a vehicle with fourth generation technology is you can stop a car in 4.5 feet. With fifth generation technology, with 5G, you can stop that same car in 1 inch. That's the dimension of difference that you're talking about, and that's why continually investing in these things is so important. But back to your point, there are areas of the country that are not sufficiently covered. And part of that is the population base isn't there, and so the providers don't have the economic incentive to do it. We've tried through various government programs to incentivize that, and we're constantly looking for ways to fine-tune and make them work better. But I got a good alert to that when I was out here a couple of weeks ago, and then I was chatting with people who are involved in emergency services. We're gonna figure out ways to step that up.
Hi, Senator. Thank you for being here. Lisa Weslick, and my question is this. When I heard that an airline landed at our Air Force base, I was a little concerned in regard to safety and how something like that could happen and the alerts that would go off and that sort of thing. So that was my concern.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, yeah, should be everybody's concern. Can you imagine if you're out there at Ellsworth Air Force Base and you see a commercial airliner coming at you? I mean, what are you going to think? I mean, that would be a very, very scary thing. Fortunately, it was a mistake. It's a mistake that happened once in history back in 2004. There was a Northwest airliner that landed at Ellsworth. And so when Delta came in and members of their leadership and the person who was in charge and has responsibility for all the Delta pilots came in and briefed me on what had happened, it was a series of circumstances that called human error. But it is scary to think that could happen, that you could have and part of it was they changed the route at the last minute. They were supposed to land from the south, which would have had them hitting Rapid City Regional first, and they rerouted them because the winds changed, so they had to come back and make a loop and come in from the north. So anyway, there was a good amount of pilot error associated with this, and they're going to make changes in their protocol, and they're going to continue to keep us briefed on what the investigation yields, additional information, and then we will react to it as appropriate.
Stan.
Yes, sir.
I'm Stan Adelstein from Rapid City. Senator, thank you for being here. Yesterday or the day before, the head of the United States Park Service testified with regards to a situation of sexual abuse. And in the process, He discussed how some people that were absolutely responsible had been ignored, and when it came up, they were moved to another office. He said he had made the same kind of personal mistakes, and he was sorry. But he basically said he couldn't have fired those people because employees of the federal government can do whatever they want. And not only that, but he didn't get fired, and he walked away. John, how can we possibly get that kind of responsibility? In fact, you talked about the FCC. When my son first became a commissioner, he had members of his staff that weren't working at all, but he couldn't fire them. He managed to get rid of them.
Yeah, well, that kind of conduct is completely inexcusable, Stan. And I can't imagine that wouldn't be grounds, even under the federal government's requirements for dismissal. But it gets at a very important fundamental point, and that is that it's very hard within the federal system, absent somebody going to jail to get rid of underperforming employees. And one of the provisions in our Indian Health Service Reform Bill allows leaders who aren't leading and aren't getting the job done to be removed. And we've tried to do the same thing with the VA because people get entrenched in these positions and you can't ever get rid of them. And that's got to change if we're going to hold people to a higher level and have some accountability and have some transparency, which I think most people who pay the bills around here think we ought to have. And so we have fundamentally got to change, in my view, particularly with these bureaucracies that are doing a subpar job. We've got to create ways in which people who aren't getting the job done, who aren't showing up, that you can get rid of them. And that sounds like a perfect example of why that's necessary.
Hello, my name is Susan. Hello. My name is Susan Campo, and I've been a teacher for 34 years. And I don't understand why, and I was very embarrassed when people said, oh, you're from South Dakota. And then we heard on the news that South Dakota had joined with 10 other states to sue the federal government about allowing transgender bathrooms for students that identified with that gender. And as a teacher, I think that's a progressive move and needed. And so I wondered how South Dakota got into that group.
Well, that probably is a question that may be more appropriately addressed to the state leaders, and I think it's probably the Attorney General that joined the lawsuit. But what I will tell you is, and I'm not, with regard to the litigation, I'm sure I'm not familiar with the background and in coming to that decision. But I do believe, and this is sort of philosophical for me, that when it comes to the issue of education, that the less that Washington is forcing down, the school districts and states' throats, mandates and requirements and that sort of thing, the better off we are. I just think education is better done at the local level. I think that school districts, I know school board members, I know administrators, I meet with them on a regular basis. I know teachers like yourself who I believe have the best interests of our kids at heart, and I think will make good decisions. And so my guess is the state was acting in response to what they perceived to be an overreach by the federal government on this issue. As to why they joined the litigation, that's something you have to take up with the people who made that decision. But as a basic matter of philosophy, my view is that we are much better served when decisions are made closer to the people who are supposed to be our interests in this case, and that's our kids. Now, we did pass one of the other things that we passed through Congress last year, and it was a huge thing, and it was another bipartisan accomplishment that I don't think people even realized got through Congress, was major educational reform. And we hadn't seen that literally since 2002. And it came through, signed into law by the president, but it's a major shift of control and power out of Washington, D.C. and the federal education department back to states. Gives them more flexibility. And I've met with lots of school board members and superintendents and principals and teachers leading up to that. And when it passed, I've met with many of them since all agree that that was long overdue. And not often that you find the teachers, unions, and the administration and everybody else kind of on the same page, but they really were. And I think that's a good thing. So I guess I'm probably not directly answering your question because I'm not sure it's a question I can answer. But what I will tell you is just a matter of basic philosophy when it comes to educating our kids. I think those decisions are better made locally.
Before I go to Stacy, was there somebody here? Was that you, Pat? You had a question? Okay, Stacy.
Hi, Senator Thune. It's good to see you again. Always love hearing you speak. And my question is about the labor force, and I wrote down some notes so I don't get off track, because anybody who's met me knows that I can. Unemployment varies by sector. Mm-hmm. You know, I work a lot in the aging services, and we have difficulties finding CNAs, jobs that require more skills, more training. There's a challenge to find people to fill those roles. So my question is, the people that you work with in Washington, are they having discussions about how to retain older workers, how to keep older people in the workforce? You know, for example, barriers to staying in, like final salary clause, which basically deters people from phased retirement because their payments are based on what their pay is. So I'm curious, are those discussions happening, thinking about older workers and the value they bring to our economy and give us capacity to grow?
Right.
Oh, I'm Lisey Brown.
Lisey, yep. Thanks, Lisey.
Sorry, apologies.
Well, it's a real challenge in South Dakota. I mean, our unemployment rate at 2.5% was the lowest in the nation, both in April and May. And there are help wanted signs all over in Sioux Falls and in our cities across South Dakota. I talk with people from various industries, and you're right, some of it varies kind of industry to industry, but as a general rule, it's just very, very hard to find workers. And I think part of it, too, is, you know, the making sure that we've got the skill sets and the training necessary for the workforce, what the workforce is demanding. And in some cases, that may mean, you know, not everybody has to have a four-year degree. There are an awful lot. Our tech schools are doing a great job of, I think, preparing and equipping people with skill sets that will meet the requirements in the workforce. I shouldn't say that. Heather Wilson's down here. She wants everybody to get a four-year degree, and especially at School of Mines and Technology, which I am happy to endorse because that is a great school. They're doing a great job out here. But I think the overall labor market right now, there are a lot of positions out there that if you have if you go to a tech school and you develop a skill, you know, there are good-paying jobs here in South Dakota. And so I think that, you know, as we look at workforce issues, you know, obviously you want to address, you want to have a workforce that's ready for what the demands of the labor force are. But I think one of the ways we can do that, and you touched on it, is encouraging people to stay in the labor force longer. There, people are living longer, more productive lives. There are people out there who, for many reasons, some of them economic, want to be in the workforce, and I think that we in our policymaking need to look for ways to incentivize that. Now, is there a specific discussion, conversation going on right now? Not at the moment, at least in terms of a legislative solution, but there is within the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which is where this a lot of this would originate, there are a lot of discussions going on about workforce issues. And I think encouraging seniors to stay active longer, you know, my dad is going to be 97, still lives in Myrtle. He's not in the workforce, but he could be. I mean, he's still very able. I shouldn't say he's, I think there are people, however, who could work 10 years, 15 years beyond what we think of as retirement age, and we need them. In South Dakota, there's a demand, you know, and particularly in the retail sector, services sector of the economy. So, good suggestion.
Bernie.
Good afternoon, Senator. I'm Bernadette Usera from Sturgis. And my question is about when they talk about the entitlements and they want to make changes in these programs. I look at the state of South Dakota in our rural areas, our smaller population, our much older population, And I become very concerned for these individuals that rely on that Social Security check that they paid into, they had to pay into it. So when I hear of Congress starting to look at privatizing Social Security, I become very concerned. I don't want to see their checks being managed by stockbrokers, Wall Street. It should be them, it should be us being able to get our own Social Security. So when does Congress stop robbing from Peter to pay Paul with Social Security monies? And how long, you know, is that going to go on until we run out of the money in Social Security, if that does happen? Are you for privatization of Social Security? And if so, why? Thank you.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm for privatization. I am for, I believe that we cannot wait forever to act, because at some point this thing goes over like this. And it's not, you know, it's not way out there. It's like in the 10-year window when, and we already, Social Security, of course, right now pays out more than it takes in. So it's operating at a cash deficit. But actuarially, supposedly, and what happens with Social Security, and the notion that there's a trust fund doesn't is a misnomer. There isn't some trust fund where those funds are locked away and they're going to pay out benefits. Basically, it's the federal government borrows money, puts a note into the fund, and says at some point in the future I'll redeem it. So it's kind of, in a way it's a any other area of our economy, any other business, they'd be in jail for probably for the way that some of these accounting mechanisms work at the federal level. Here's what I would say: I am not somebody who believes, because my dad is very dependent upon Social Security and Medicare, and others I know that for most that's their own income. It's a fixed income, and they have to be protected. People are nearing retirement age. I think any of the reforms that are talked about would be for people who are under the age of 55, people who younger workers. I think that younger people in our economy today, if they want Social Security to be there for them when they retire, are going to have to, they're going to have to be some changes made. One very simple change, which can be phased in, and it doesn't have to affect, again, people retired today or nearing retirement age, is a phase in an increase in retirement age. We talked about earlier, people are living longer, more productive lives. That's unpopular, but if you look at actuarially, this thing doesn't work. A lot of these programs are going to go belly up, and they're going to have to be huge reductions in benefits, massive increases in taxes, or some form of reforming the program. So I guess what I would say to you is, and another thing that's been talked about in some of these programs is some sort of an income test, where you would have high-income individuals, and we do this a little bit with Medicare already, particularly in the prescription drug program, wouldn't get as much of a benefit. Or might pay in a little bit more. I mean, there are ways, reforms in these programs, I think, that can be accomplished if we're willing to do the hard things that don't affect the people that you're talking about. The individual in living in a rural community in South Dakota who has as their only source of income Social Security, I get that. And we can't, whatever we do, affect people like that. But what we do have to do is, for these young guys down here, we may have to come up with a different system that recognizes the changes that are occurring and make sure that these programs are aligned with the demographic changes of the country. Because we are living longer, more productive lives, people are on these programs longer, and I think at some point for younger Americans, we've got to figure out a way to reform these programs. And those are a couple of suggestions that have been mentioned. And, another one is allowing people who, we have something that's called the Thrift Savings Plan. It's a federal employee program where they can choose some different things and where they want to, put their money, and most of them are government-backed. So you'd still have the government backing involved, but it would give people more choices and hopefully a higher return than they might be getting today. There's a whole range of things that are being discussed, but until we get the political courage to take this issue on. We're going to continue to look at this cliff out there, which is getting closer and closer in the windshield.
Thank you for your service. I'm Ann Eads, and my question is, what are we doing about the national debt? It affects all of us.
Right. So. Yeah, well, the deficit, which everybody points to now and says has come down for a few years, starts to explode again over the next decade. And that's why, you know, some of these discussions that we're having about getting spending under control and all that is part of the solution. And we've squeezed kind of everything we can out of the discretionary side of spending. If you think of spending as a big pie, federal spending, about a third of that pie is composed of spending for defense, national security, and spending on what we call non-defense discretionary or domestic programs. So that's like roads, education, you know, parks, things like that. But now two-thirds of that pie is in what we call mandatory spending, entitlement programs. So it's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, things like that, that Congress doesn't annually appropriate for. They're called entitlement programs because if you're eligible, you're entitled to it. And if we don't affect that part of the budget, the overall federal budget, this trajectory that we're on is gets much, much worse over time. So that's why I say we have to get serious about reforming those programs and figure out ways to make them sustainable, not just for people who are on them today, but for future generations of Americans as well. The other solution, as I mentioned earlier, is if you want to get the debt and the deficit under control, get the economy growing faster. And that's the part that I don't think a lot of people realize. And when people like me say, we need pro-growth policies, we need tax reform that encourages people to make investment decisions based upon the best return as opposed to what the tax consequence is. We need to lessen the heavy hand of regulation on people who are trying to create jobs out there to get that growth rate back up. I mean, there is no reason why our economy shouldn't be growing at that 3% or north of their rate that's a historical average. And for every 1 percentage point increase in economic growth, as I mentioned earlier, you generate about $300 billion a year in additional tax revenue. So that starts to make these fiscal problems look a lot smaller by comparison. So it's restraining the rate of growth and reforming programs on the mandatory side of the federal budget that are in need of reform to make them operate in a more sustainable way. But then secondly, it's what can we do? What policies can we put in place that will generate faster, more robust economic growth that will create that vibrant economy that generates additional federal revenue? I mean, growth is a huge, huge solver of a lot of the problems that we face as a nation. And by the way, I would support and have, since I got to office, an amendment to the Constitution that would require a balanced budget. I just think that we're at the federal level, every state, not every, but almost every state does it, has a requirement to balance the budget. And if we had that at the federal level, a lot of these issues would have been confronted a long time ago. But when you can just put it on the credit card and hand the bill to your kids, it becomes a very easy thing to do. Yeah.
Hi, my name is LaFon Janice, and I'm a small business owner here in Rapid City. I want to thank you for addressing that IHS leaders need to be held accountable and transparent. I wanted to know what the status of your bill was that you tried to pass. And if you could take IHS by the reins, what would you recommend? And okay, what is Washington's take on IHS okay now?
All right. Thanks, LaVon. Well, okay.
And what is the realistic timeline? And I know it would be years, but what would be a realistic timeline for change for IHS, okay, in your view?
What's your biggest question? What's the most important question?
Okay. Okay. Well, first off, I mean, I think that in terms of the legislation, we had a hearing in D.C. in February. We invited leaders from the South Dakota tribes to come out and testify, in which they laid out some of these horrible conditions in the emergency rooms in Rosebud and Pine Ridge. We had a hearing here in Rapid City in June. So we've tried to listen and take what the tribal leaders have told us and try to distill that and put it into a piece of legislation. So we have a bill, and I introduced it along with Senator John Barrasso, who is the chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee in the Senate, and I'm hoping we'll get action on it. It hasn't moved yet, but it has a number of provisions in it that I think create, one, more transparency and accountability from the leaders at IHS, two, incentives to get to recruit and retain healthcare professionals to serve in our tribal communities. Three, fiscal responsibility, because a lot of dollars that are supposed to go to patient care get used in the IHS bureaucracy, particularly at the end of the year. Four, more consultation with the tribes. Five, protections for whistleblowers when things go wrong, and allowing the inspector general, when a death occurs, to be able to investigate that and hold people accountable. So it's got a whole series of things in it that we think help. But to your point, what's the best thing we could do? I think ultimately the tribes have to make the decisions, and we can't come to them and say this is what we think you should do or that we're going to impose a solution. I think that it's got to come from them. But one of the things that they're talking about is a way to take that function that's performed today by the IHS and have a Rapid City Regional or an Avera or a Sanford or somebody like that come in and perform those services on a contractual basis instead of having, you know, the IHS do it, because these are folks who do this for a living and do it pretty well here in South Dakota. And I know that the tribes are, there's at least a conversation now about what I think are some fairly innovative ideas and solutions. And I hope that we can come to a point where there's an agreement on a path forward, and I'm anxious to be a part of that discussion. But our bill, I think, is an important starting point. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
I already took the last question.
Oh, Before
I ask the last question, I just want to recognize, and Jeff, that's okay, but I think that the senator has the best corner man in the state and Kasai. What do you say? You know, he had as many Democrats as Republicans at the 4th of July celebration. I really treasure that aspect, Kasai. I always get the chance to ask, and it's sort of a two-part question, because, you know, I see you on TV a lot behind Senator McConnell. You ever get the urge just to go like that for him? And secondly, what's your relationship to Hillary Clinton and her running mate, Tim Kaine? What kind of collaboration have you got there, John?
Okay. Well, in answer to your first question, I try not to push people out of the way. But but I do, you know, I mean, you're part of a leadership team, and, you know, I try and do my part to influence and shape the discussions that we have and the direction that we take in the end. And we have a fairly, I would say, cohesive leadership team in the Senate. But Senator McConnell got elected by our members as our leader, and so we try and do what we can to support him. We offer constructive advice and criticism when necessary, in terms of the direction. But with respect to Hillary and Tim Kaine, I don't know Tim Kaine as well because he hasn't been there as long, but when I got to the Senate, I was on the Armed Services Committee with Hillary Clinton. And I'd say she's she is studious. She does her homework. She always comes prepared. And we have very different opinions and views on some of the issues. And I know that I talked with her after the 2008 election, in which she ran for president the first time, and I remember her telling me that one of the most satisfying and rewarding wins that she had in that primary election was South Dakota. And I think that might have been because Bill Walsh and people like him were for President Obama in that primary election. But when Tim Kaine, you know, got to the Senate, and everything they say about him is true. I mean, he's a genuinely good guy. And again, I mean, we're going to have differences of opinion. That's what elections are about. That's what I think elections are fundamentally about, differences. And you know, there will be some fairly clear differences and clear choice, I think, this fall. But just on a human level, from a, you know, personal standpoint, you know, he's just a genuinely good guy. And so anyway.
Thanks again, Senator. Thank you. It's great.
Reminder, Christy Nome will be, Representative Nome will be here next month, and then followed again by Paula Hawks and Jay Williams. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. Thanks again to all of you for coming out and having a civil discussion. Isn't America great, and isn't South Dakota a great place to live? I mean,